and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, June 14, 2019. A senior Trump administration official says South Sudanese are responsible for ending violence in their country.
The South Sudanese parties should implement the peace agreement without delay, move forward, and let's not let the events in Sudan impact in a negative way.
And the military leaders in Sudan accept responsibilities for killing protesters.
The main points that they were highlighting during this press conference were, first of all, they pledged to accept the Ethiopian mediation proposal to resume talks with the opposition group and reach to a final political settlement in the country.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. But we first go to Khartoum, where the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Steve O'Nagy, briefed journalists today through a telephone conference call from Khartoum on the situation in Sudan. O'Nagy says the U.S. is closely monitoring events in Sudan, which he says could impact affairs in the neighboring South Sudan.
We, the international community, need to make sure that the events in Sudan do not negatively impact the ongoing process in South Sudan. So rest assured that everybody is very cognizant of that. As a matter of fact, that we also discussed with the with members of the government in Sudan, but also with our partners who are following the South Sudanese peace process. So yes, we are also concerned about that because we do not want the events in Sudan to negatively impact the process in South Sudan.
The top U.S. diplomat says the U.S. is still following the progress in the implementation of the South Sudan peace deal signed last year in Addis Ababa. O'Nagy says South Sudanese are responsible for bringing peace in their country.
If the Sudanese situation deteriorates into chaos in Sudan, that obviously would have a very, very negative impact on the process in South Sudan. From the United States' point of view remains that the South Sudanese parties should implement the peace agreement without delay, move forward, and let's not let the events in Sudan impact in a negative way. Over.
That was U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Steve O'Nagy, during a telephone briefing with journalists today from Khartoum on the situation in Sudan. Sudan's military leaders have accepted responsibility for shooting protesters. The spokesman of the Transitional Military Council told journalists in Khartoum yesterday that the outcome of an investigation into the killings of at least 100 protesters will be released next week. The military rulers have also called on the pro-democracy coalition to return to the negotiating table. Our reporter Mongo Ugali has been following developments in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
The main points that they were highlighting during this press conference were, first of all, they pledged to accept the Ethiopian mediation proposal to resume talks with the opposition group and reach to a final political settlement in the country. The spokesman for the Transitional Military Council, Shamsuddin Kabashi, says the council, remained committed to any genuine political agreement that can bring stability in Sudan. So he actually called on the mediation to immediately call for the resumption of the talks within 24 hours since last evening. And the other point, Kabashi said the military council, they don't support the idea of relocating the talks to Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, because the remaining disagreement is only around the issue of the percentage of leadership council, which he says is something normal that can be resolved within the country with a consensus between the two groups. So there is no need of, relocating the talks all through to Ethiopia again. In regards to the incident even of June 3rd, the military council admits that the instruction given to the security on June 3rd was to clear the Colombia area. Colombia here is an area under the bridge that linking Khartoum North to Khartoum Town. So they say that instruction was given to them only to clear that area because they feel that area has a lot of criminals that are, you know, causing havoc and causing insecurity even to the protesters at the military headquarters. But they finally say they will take full responsibility of whatever the results of the two committees. One is under the Chief Justice and another one is also formed by the Military Council. So the two results are expected to come out on Saturday, which is tomorrow, according to Shamsuddin Kadbashi.
What about response from the activists? Is there anything, is there any response from the coalition of the opposition and the activists? Did they respond to that?
The press briefing was yesterday, which is Thursday evening, and today is Friday, and, you know, it is a weekend here, so we could not, I didn't get any reaction, or, you know, there was no any statement by the opposition, neither by any other political group in response to the statement given by Shamsuddin Kadbashi in the press conference last night.
So what about the issue of the American delegation in town? I mean, there are top diplomats who have been there, including Ambassador Donald Booth there in Khartoum. Did the military council speak about that?
Yes, in regards to the visit of the American diplomats to Khartoum, yes, he said the delegation met with the head of the military council and they discussed a lot about, you know, the situation in Sudan. But one of the key points he stressed on it is that he says the Americans support the efforts of the AU into the addition of the Ethiopian government, instead of, you know, relying on any other external efforts like European Union and other international community to come up with the solution. But they say, as the Americans, they support the efforts of the African Union, which is already been done. And but at the end of the day, he also said the special envoy said they support any agreement that can bring, you know, settlement and bring whatever ambitious for the Sudanese people according to what they want. So he did not mention anything about the force, like American being threatening them in any sanction and all, but that was how the talks end, according to his statement yesterday.
Is there anything that the military leaders talked about that is worth mentioning?
In regards to the points, you know, agreed in the previous talks, in previous series of talks before the talks could collapse or before the incident of June 3rd, Kadbashi mentioned that they agreed on the, 3 years of transitional period. First of all, the military council was suggesting 2 years and the opposition was suggesting 4 years. But at the end of the day, they came to a consensus of 3 years of a transitional period. The other point is they also agreed on the representation in executive and the legislation from both opposition and the military council.
That's our reporter Mungu Ugali speaking with me from Khartoum earlier today. Ambassador Donald Booth, who served as the Sudan and South Sudan envoy under U.S. President Barack Obama, is back to the State Department to reclaim the position of Special Envoy for Sudan. Booth's track record, however, could overshadow his appointment. While he was envoy, South Sudan slid back into conflict, and the conflicts in Sudan did not stop while Booth was in office. But Joshua Metsevi, a senior policy analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Washington-based Heritage Foundation, does not think shortcomings of the past will hinder Booth's ability to lead a special envoy for Sudan.
U.S. policy towards South Sudan was unsuccessful. I think we can all agree on that. But that was not for lack of trying from the special envoy, Donald Booth, at the time, and his office and his people. I think it was a failure of American foreign policy and strategy. So to me, his current legacy is that he was a senior official who worked very hard in a very difficult environment and did his absolute best in, as I say, really trying circumstances.
But the unsuccessful nature of his tenure as the envoy is a sticking point to a lot of people. And I've heard from people who have said that he's really not the right choice, you know, based on his approach to South Sudan, his approach to Riek Machar in South Sudan. The conflict in 2016 happened under his watch. And I've spoken to a lot of human rights activists who are very unhappy with the U.S. approach with trying to normalize relations with Sudan. And this also happened under his watch. Knowing all of this, knowing that there is some tension, you know, based on your expertise, do you think that he is the right man for the job?
I think it's important to remember that he was not the final arbiter of American foreign policy in any of those situations, either the normalization with Sudan or the American foreign policy towards South Sudan. So yes, he was an important senior official, but at the end of the day, he was also someone who had to execute orders on orders. And I think the failures of particularly South Sudanese policy started at a much higher level than the special envoy level. Sudan, this recent normalization process, again, that was agreed in various sectors of the U.S. government and appeared to have some momentum and some possibility of success until this recent wave of protests. So I think it was always a very difficult and fraught project to try to normalize with Sudan. And these protests and the very brutal crackdown response by the security services have sort of proven that, yet again, Khartoum is not, at least for now, at least given the current situation, is not a responsible actor and not someone with whom the U.S. should consider really close ties with.
Which makes Ambassador Booth's job even more critical. You know, based on your relationship and based on what you've seen, what type of advice do you think Ambassador Booth will give? What is his style? Especially because Sudan, as you said, is in such a pivotal moment.
Well, I've never worked with him in any sort of official capacity, so I haven't seen him in those types of moments. My impression is that, again, he's a career Foreign Service officer, so he takes a very diplomatic tone. I think he generally prefers working behind the scenes and relying on persuasion and diplomatic skill to try to move people. My sense is that he's less comfortable with more dramatic sticks, so to speak, rather than carrots when trying to persuade.
Joshua, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
As I said at the beginning, this is a really difficult situation he's taking on here. He does have good experience in the region, but the U.S. cannot solve Sudan regardless. This has to be up to the Sudanese people, and I am sure that Booth knows that, and I hope that he will, and others who are working very hard on this project will move forward in that spirit of really looking to the Sudanese to come up with a civilian-led transition and doing what we can to support that process.
That's Joshua Mesevi, a senior policy analyst for Africa at the Middle East Heritage Foundation here in Washington. He was speaking to my colleague Ayen Deng-Bior. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, three UN agencies sound the alarm bell about acute food insecurity in South Sudan. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today
What is your favorite game and how is it played?
Cricket, there's a batsman and the bowler. The bowler throws the ball to the batsman and the batsman tries to hit the ball as far as possible.
Yeah, I'll tell you, the favorite game, I like it. I like kickboxing, but when I was in Sudan there, my dream is just to be a big kickboxer. That's what I like. Yes, it's not about just to kick people, Just because I think it's just a game, But I like it. Because me, I like something, can enjoy the play. It's just a game, yeah.
My favorite game is chess. How it is played is we have a chessboard where pieces are set. It is now two kingdoms fighting against each other.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Three UN agencies in South Sudan say 7 million South Sudanese will face acute level of food insecurity by the end of July. The head of South Sudan's Bureau of Statistics says unless the conditions are reversed, tens of thousands of people will struggle to put food on the table for their families. Dimo Silva Aurelio has more for VOA from Juba.
South Sudan Bureau of Statistics Chairman Isaiah Chol Arwai says the Integrated Food Security Pest Classification Report released today shows that the food security situation in South Sudan is deteriorating with much of the population facing acute food security levels right now.
In May to June to July 2019, an estimated 6.96 million people, roughly 61% of the national population, are likely to face crisis IPC phase 3, acute food insecurity or worse, out of which an estimated 1.82 million people will face emergency IPC phase 4, acute food insecurity.
The IPC report estimates that 21,000 people will likely face a catastrophic lack of food access or IPC phase 5, the highest level in the 5-step classification. NRY says about 5 million will be in crisis.
Of the people estimated to be in catastrophe in May to July 2019, 10,000 are in Canal and Pigi of former Jonglei State, 10,000 are in Chuaibet of former Lake State, and 1,000 are in Panyikang of former Upper Nile State.
An IPC report released earlier this year estimated that 6.4 million South Sudanese would face acute food insecurity between February and April of this year, and that number has now peaked. Arai says the food security situation will continue to deteriorate due to population displacement, intercommunal conflict, low crop production, macroeconomic crisis, climatic shocks, and humanitarian assistance delivery challenges. Juba resident Grace Marco says families in rural areas especially need help.
Recently in Rokon, I think in January, those people there, they said totally, there is nothing. I don't know, but they're talking of humanitarian assistance. I don't know whether they reach those people there, because those people there, they're really suffering. They said nothing to be eat.
Xiu Wei Lee, head of the UN's World Food Programme in South Sudan, says every year hunger reaches new and unprecedented levels in South Sudan.
With millions of people unsure where their next meal will come from, particularly at this time of the year when the hunger peaks from May to July.
Lee says in order to address food insecurity, the World Food Programme intends to reach 5 million people by the end of the year with food and cash distribution assistance. On a bright note, although the number of children at risk of acute malnutrition remains around 860,000, UNICEF says the overall case of malnutrition have fallen in South Sudan. Biram Diaye, the chief nutritionist at UNICEF for South Sudan, says the malnutrition situation has gone from very high in 2010 to only high in 2018.
We had 23% of children who were acutely malnourished in 2010, and now we have 13%.
In order to avoid acute food insecurity, the agencies recommended scaling up provisions of humanitarian assistance to support livestock keepers and to improve access to basic services. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio, in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Uganda. The confirmation of Ebola cases in Uganda this week has panicked residents living near the border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. The residents fear screening points are insufficient and that the disease could hit their district. However, Uganda's government says it has stepped up Ebola screening at all entry points into the country. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Residents on the shores of the Ugandan side of Lake Albert say boats carrying Congolese refugees dock on a daily basis. They are worried that in the wake of two Ebola deaths in Kasese border district, the deadly hemorrhagic fever could easily spill to other districts as many of the Congolese enter Uganda unscreened. Stephen Mande is a resident of Hoima district on the shores of Lake Albert.
There is an Ebola case in Kasese, and there is no proper measures from the government that is put in places around the landing sites to screen foreigners, so our lives are at stake.
Since last December, Uganda has had an influx of Congolese refugees fleeing tribal clashes in Lendu. An estimated 25,000 people also cross from Congo daily, mostly to trade and seek health care in Uganda. However, health officials say surveillance has been heightened to ensure all DRC residents who enter Uganda are thoroughly screened for Ebola. Dr. Frederick Bienume is the Hoima District Health Officer.
We are training health workers around that point, and we are training also community-based health providers for surveillance, including the beach management units. We are putting them on board, or any manager in the fishing and the community leaders, so that they do an assessment, because we are aware people can come in and enter the community without our notes, but they will be directing them to our screening points.
Dr. Jane Ruth Acheng, Uganda's health minister, says no border crossings are planned due to the Ebola outbreak. Instead, screening points will be instituted at all entry points, including ports, landing sites and airports.
And we have agreed that from today onwards, they will have people to man the porous borders on both sides. Uganda doesn't have security challenges, and our response teams are moving to all parts of the country, but specifically concentrating efforts in Kasese.
In Kasese district, 6 Ebola checkpoints have been erected. The isolation center at Entebbe International Airport, which has been idle for months, has been reinstituted. Uganda President Yoweri Museveni has urged the public to avoid handshakes, hugs, public gatherings and burials to help prevent the spread of Ebola. Early this week, Uganda confirmed 3 cases of Ebola, 2 of whom have died. They were part of a family that crossed from DRC after nursing and burying a sick relative. 1 Ebola patient and 4 suspected cases, all members of the same family, have been repatriated to DRC for further treatment. Uganda's health ministry says that leaves no confirmed case of Ebola in the country at the moment. Uganda has had 5 Ebola outbreaks since 2000. These are the first confirmed cases outside the DRC since current outbreak was reported in August. As of June 4th, 2025 confirmed and probable cases have been recorded in the DRC, with 2/3 dying. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
South Sudanese authorities say child labor remains a huge problem in their country. Today, the world marks a day against child labor, and some children in South Sudan make a living by shining shoes along streets. The children say they have no other options because they lost their parents during the war and have no one to care for them. Viola Elias reports for VOA from Juba.
Looking exhausted, a 16-year-old Marok Mayar sits by the roadside near the University of Juba Custom Campus. Marok is wearing a torn, dirty clothes and a flip-flop. A few pairs of shoes and a dirty torn bag are strewn on the ground. Marok stares at passerbys and sometimes gestures to them to allow him to polish their shoes. Speaking in Arabic, Marok says he was separated from his parents during July 2016 conflict in Wau, and to this day does not know if his parents are dead or alive. Marok says he came to Juba in February to search for his brother.
Unfortunately, when I arrived, I was told my brother has gone to another place, so there was no place for me to stay. That is why I came to work on the streets as a shoe shiner in order to earn a living. Right now we are three boys staying together.
A 15-year-old Deng Aliu also shines shoes in Juba Custom Market and, like Marok, is an orphan. Deng says he would love to be in school but has no one to pay his tuition fees.
For now, I just need money. Nothing else. That's why I came to work here, polishing shoes. If I'm given a chance, I would love to go to school.
After shining shoes for the whole day, Marok Den and a third boy often sleep in an unfinished deserted house in the Juba Nabari area known as Tomping. The South Sudan Child Act 2008, Article 25, provides for the protection of every child from exposure to economic exploitation and child labor. This includes working in places like bar, hotels, where a child may be exposed to immoral behaviors or manual labor that could injure them, such as carrying heavy loads. Sebit Badrilaku, the Inspector of Social Welfare at the Jubek State Gender, Child and Social Welfare Ministry, says the problem of child labor is widespread in South Sudan.
They are supposed to go to education because Child Act provides a privilege for them to have right in education. So it is economical labor that they are doing so that they at least have to find something that they feed at home. So it becomes a problem to the government of Central Equatoria to at least see into these cases of children working on the street or working in the market. So as government, we actually need to empower our social workers to go and so that they will be able to go and see the cases of children who are in the market, who are in the streets, working, doing business. At least so that the number will be reduced.
Speaking in Arabic, Sarah John, a mother of four, says poverty forces many children to work so they can help feed their families.
I am advising other mothers not to give chance to child labor. Even if there is poverty at home, they should not allow their children to go out on the street. I'd rather go out and struggle as a mother so that my children can eat, dress well and go to school.
A parent of two who prefer to be identified only as Imi says he feels pity whenever he sees children working in the street, children who are supposed to be in school.
If you can't take all of them to school, then you can at least divide them. To us parents, if you are given a child, be responsible, please. Try with the little resources you have to make sure the child doesn't leave your house before the child is 18.
The International Labour Organization launched the World Day Against Child Labour in 2002 to focus attention on the global extent of child labour and the action and efforts needed to eliminate it. According to the United Nations, 152 million children across the world are forced to work. Most of them are in agriculture. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
That's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song Agamlong Agar by Akoi Jazz Band. We have been listening to Akoi Jazz Band with the song Yin Jamlong Agar. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Have a peaceful weekend and join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Oh, no.
dim yoku na ku yin jandi.
Adan
ku yin jandi. Nyan wu ne dim yoku na ku yin jandi.
Adan ku yin jandi.